So good morning. It's really, we're really towards the end of the school, and I think everybody is a bit, overworked. So please don't hesitate. So I know at this state, it's very easy to lose the lecture, and then it's hard to come back. So please don't hesitate to ask questions, okay? So the subject of my lecture is actually quantum. So the title was Quantum NP. And the complexity of ground states. And what I want to do is I want to tell you how, basically, we've been hearing a lot about complexity classes like BQP, P, QMA complete. I mean, these words were sort of thrown into the air. And what I want to do in this lecture is to actually give you a meaning, an exact meaning to those words, and then explain how this language, which is the basic language of computational complexity, how can it be used to interpret things or to address questions that are of interest to physicists, for example, how long? How long would it take for a system to relax to its ground state for a given system? And how complex is the entanglement in its ground state? And so we're going to give meaning to the words, to words like P and BQP and NP and hardness and reduction and QMA complete. That's going to be a main player in this lecture. And somehow understand how to use this language in order to argue or give some insights about ground states of local Hamiltonians and about other physical questions. So basically, I should say that this is sort of part this is basically the basics of what's called the quantum Hamiltonian complexity area, sub-area of quantum computation, in which we are trying to understand the complexity of ground states. So basically what Giffre was talking about yesterday was an attempt to look at the set of ground states and sort of understand which states we can give efficient descriptions for. And what quantum complexity can say is when that cannot be done and what are the limitations. And there is a lot of interplay between this is sort of hard and this is sort of easy, computationally easy and computationally hard, in a way which we're going to define. And that gives meaning to this attempt to classify different ground states according to this. So it gives sort of a roadmap. So we're going to I'm going to start my lecture with very at the hardcore computer science, like very rigorous or close to rigorous definitions of P, BPP, BQP, etc. And I'm going to work my way towards physics towards the end of the talk. Insights to physical questions. And the main player in the middle here is going to be quantum NP, whose complete problem, in the sense that I will explain, is the problem of approximating the ground energy of a given local Hamiltonian. And from that, we will be able to deduce various insights. OK, so we're going to start here. And basically, my starting point is where Stephen Jordan started as well, or what he talked about, which is this. He had two bobs. One was the universal classical computational models, and the other was the universal quantum computational models. Here was Turing machines and circuits and things that we didn't define, lambda calculus and other things, game of life. That's classical. And here we have quantum, which is TQFT and adiabatic computation and quantum circuit model. Okay. So in fact, I want to define this in a slightly different way, in which this bob will actually contain this bob, will be larger. And so, okay, this is going to be the BQP complete set of problems, and this is the P complete problems. Okay, so so what kind of problems are we usually interested in? Okay, so in computer science language, we usually look at input and output. And for example, that could be a problem like we're given a classical Ising-spin model, Jij, Si, Sj for I, a neighbor of J. And we want to know whether there is a configuration of spins, plus or minus 1. These can be thought of, say, also as plus or minus 1. And is there a configuration for which the energy is less than a given number A? OK? So the output will be yes if there is such a configuration, and no if there is not such a configuration. So this, the input to this problem is, do you know? The J's. The J's are the input to the problem. So Jij will be my input. And the output is there a configuration such that the energy of Si is less than A? OK, so that's one problem. Another problem, another possible problem, is, say, factoring, in which the input is a large number n, given in binary representation. So it means that actually the input has logarithmically many bits here. And the answer is the factors of n. We actually like usually to talk about decision problems in computer science. For reasons, we can actually usually move from problems that are not decision problems, that is, problems that their answers are just yes or no. We can move from more general problems to decision problems. So for example, factoring n, you could actually represent it as a decision problem by asking, is there a factor, so your input will be n and b, and you're asking, is there a factor of n which is less than b? And if you know how to solve that, you can also solve factoring by basically doing binary search, asking whether there is a factor below b or above b, and then searching logarithmic. That takes logarithmically in n. So OK, so that makes me able, and usually this is possible to do, so I will just talk about decision problems for the sake of this talk. Okay? Okay, so let's define P. Okay, so what's P? P is the class of problems that can be solved in polynomial time. So this is, for us, the class of problems that are tractable for us. These are the problems that we think we can do efficiently, we can solve efficiently. More formally, P will be, we talk about L, a language, which is the set of instances for which the output is one. You can just think of this as a problem. So a language is in P if there exists, so that could be factoring or de-Ising spin model or whatnot. And if there exists an algorithm, a classical algorithm, which runs in polynomial time, and we'll explain a little bit more about it in a moment, such that for all x of n bits, for all n, a of x, let's write it this way, if x is an L, then a of x is 1, and if x is not an L, then a of x is 0. Is it clear what I mean by that? No. Yes. Okay, so that's what I'm going to do now. So A is a classical algorithm, and I'm going to think of the classical algorithm as the following thing. It's actually one parameter family of circuits. We have, what's a circuit? A circuit is some kind of a description of an algorithm which gets its input here, n bits, and outputs something here. It can also use some constants if it wants that are not part of the input. And what's sitting here in the nodes are gates like and or, which just take the Boolean variables here, x1 and x2, and compute the value and propagates it to the next edge. And then this node takes this input, computes the value, and then outputs at the end the value. So we want these circuits to be of polynomial size. Okay, so this is P. Yeah, there were several other questions. Does this clarify it? Or? Yeah.
Can you say what you mean by language again? What's L?
Yeah, L is a subset of n-bit strings for all n. So it's just better to think about it, fix an n, and then L is some subset of the strings. For example, if I fix n and my language is the set of all Ising models like this, so the set, this is my language, then the L will consist of all j, I, j, and a, the binary description of them, such that the energy is less than 1. The energy is less than a. Yes?
Subset corresponds to a good instance,
that's not true. Actually didn't want to get into this small details, but in the sort of in the basic 101 complexity, you would say the algorithm needs to answer any input. And it would need to recognize whether the input is a valid input, regardless of what's the output. It would need to recognize whether the input is really a valid input as a Hamiltonian. You could. So just let me repeat Daniel's questions. Basically, Daniel says, I should somehow forbid myself inserting into this definition the ability to recognize whether some input is a valid input in some that fits this problem, because that could be sometimes very difficult. And it's true. And sometimes you can sort of, and in fact, we are talking all the time about such cases. And this is called promise problems. We're sort of promised in many cases that our input satisfies these restrictions. But in this particular case, this is not a problem. You can always, this is very easy to distinguish whether Jij and A are valid inputs. That has nothing to do with actually knowing the answer. Okay? I'm actually going to sweep another small detail under the rug. Hopefully nobody will catch me. Yeah. I'm sorry? Yeah, right. That's exactly the thing that I was referring to. I'm going to sweep that under the rug. The question was, isn't that P slash poly? And for the complexity, people in the audience, you understand what you're saying, and you can correct me in your notebooks. And for the other people, it just doesn't matter. let me just comment one sentence so that you're not, you don't feel like you're, you don't understand what I'm talking about. The sentence is, the question was, isn't this P slash poly? And it actually, in humans language, it actually means, can't I somehow encode into the very definition of the circuit some extremely hard problem? If I just want the circuit to be polynomial size, maybe I could just somehow hardwire into the circuit the answers to very difficult problems. And that's true, and you actually need to require that the circuit themselves can be designed efficiently by another machine. I'm going to ignore that. Yeah, another question? Yeah. Yeah, thank you. That's the input. So this is my input, which is, in this case, Jij and A. This is my instance to the problem. Thank you. And the output is there a configuration SISJ such that the energy is less than something? Okay, more questions? Okay. So that's P, and and in fact, I want, just for the sake, we're not going to use this class, but just for the sake of simplicity, I'm going to introduce another class which is not very relevant. We're going to forget it after we use it, which is BPP. I think it was 40 years ago, 50 years ago, there was a revolution in computer science by which people understood that introducing randomness into computation could actually help computation a lot. If you just give up a little bit on the desire to be correct all the time, and just, it's okay to be correct almost all the time, then suddenly things become much nicer. Try it. Allows you to do more things. For example, primality had an algorithm, just deciding whether a number is prime or not, had a randomized algorithm for a long time. until people found a deterministic algorithm. So I want to actually modify my definition of P to allow randomness. BPP, that's for bounded probabilistic polynomial time. And that's the same as P, except my algorithm now can also be described by a sequence of circuits. Say, here it was Cn. So this will be also Cn, but this Cn will now get access to random bits. So we're adding here to the picture the ability to use random bits, say R1, R2, et cetera. And now we want to require that the answer is correct with good probability. So we require that X is an L. If X is an L, then A of X and R, the probability for that to be 1, probability over R, is larger than, say, 2/3. And if X is not an L, then the probability for over R for A XR to be 0, which is the right answer, is also larger than 2/3. So that's error probability 1/3. And the thing is that we would like to have robust notions of models of computation. And this is a robust notion. And in fact, this is the reason for this funny word bounded here. Bounded means that this error, which is 1/3, 1 minus 2/3, is far away from half. Once it's far away from half, if I repeat this experiment, this algorithm, again, 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 each time with independent random bits, it's like a flip of a coin. And I can take the majority, and I can estimate whether the probability is larger than 2/3 or for 1, or the probability is larger than 2/3 for 0. I can estimate that with exponential confidence. So I can basically amplify the probability of success to essentially 1 minus an exponentially small error in polynomial time. So that's actually a problem in the problem set, that this actually works exponentially fast. OK, so if you repeat an experiment polynomially many times, the error decays exponentially. So I can actually assume that this is exponentially small. OK, so the reason why I wanted to define BPP, except for just giving you the whole picture, is really just to talk about the simplification in a setting which is not quantum. I should say that nowadays, complexity people strongly believe that BPP is in fact equal to P, that randomness doesn't bias anything. And that's it's a major open problem. We don't know, but there are very good indications that this is true. OK. So now how, yeah?
Why are you taking a sequence?
So it's the same thing. An algorithm is just described by some way to solve a problem for any size of the problem. OK? So that's the sequence. Thanks.
You've got a question as well about asking how this the number of random bits.
Yeah, I'm going to assume, since I'm assuming that everything here is, I didn't write it, but it's supposed to follow this. It runs in polynomial time. And for that, it means that also the circuit is of polynomial size, which means that the number of random bits that I'm allowed to use is polynomial in the size of the input. OK. So now, So now I can proceed to, so this P, yeah, another question? Okay, yeah.
So can a new point be a random string of bits?
I'm sorry?
No,
I'm actually, so the question was, can the input be a random string of bits? I'm actually treating the input as if I really want to solve that particular input. It's a very interesting question whether you can actually talk about complexity in the average case of solving typical inputs. Apparently, the whole theory, that would be, it's a major open problem of actually making a meaningful full complexity theory for typical inputs. This is, I would say there's not enough work on this. There's not enough understanding on this. Yes?
So if you gave us two examples to state what you mean by algorithms and so on, but you didn't mean to say that.
Yeah, thank you. So that's what I meant to write to say here. Maybe we'll actually put this diagram here. So this is going to be P, the set of problems solvable in polynomial time by a classical computer. And let's put BPP very close to it. This is BPP, set of problems solvable in polynomial time by a classical computer with access to random bits. Now, this class of problems contains various problems. And I do not mean to say that the problems I gave an example for are such problems. Examples that you are very familiar with is, for example, linear equations. The min cut or the max flow problem. Euclid's algorithm. There are many polynomial time efficient algorithms. Computing the correlation function in a mirror, like Giffre showed yesterday, is a problem in P. And in fact, in today's focus talk, Adam will discuss the complexity of tensor networks in the more general sense. So that's P and BPP, and this is classical computation. And now I want to define the class BQP, which corresponds to quantum computation. Call it BQP. Let's give
an example of a program which is BQP that
not. Yeah. So the problem of testing the identity of many variable polynomials is such a problem. In fact, we don't have any more. We used to have this primality test, but that's gone. So it looks like the most important problem here that is not known to be here is polynomial identity testing. So what's BQP? BQP is the same, but with a quantum circuit instead of a classical circuit. So BQP. I'm sorry? Let's do that over later. BQP. What's BQP? So BQP is a set of languages that are solvable in polynomial time on a quantum computer using a sequence of, for a fixed n, you have a quantum circuit that works on those n input bits. The input is still classical. It's the process that is quantum. Okay? So L is in BQP, think of factoring, for example, we'll give later examples. So L is in BQP if there exists a polynomial time quantum algorithm, which again I'm going to think of as some sequence of quantum circuits, each of them acting on n input bits. And each of those circuits is as you've seen in previous lectures in the summer school, each of those circuits will consist of, say they would be 2-qubit gates or 3-qubit gates, that it will consist of these sequence of gates, time will go this way, and it will consist of polynomially many such gates, and it might actually, if the input is here x1 to xn, it can act on some more qubits, which will be called the ancilla qubits. Okay? And I want the quantum algorithm to satisfy exactly the same requirements. X is in L if the probability, I'm going to write this loosely, the probability that Qn of X tensor 0 on the ancilla qubits, that probability that this value is going to be 1, meaning the trace of this with this vector, you know how to write this more formally, this probability is at least 2/3. And if X is not an L, then the probability of Qn X 0 is 0, is larger than 2/3. Coming back to Giffre's question, to Daniel's question about promise problems, this is a promise problem. If I'm given, I'm sorry? This thing? This is just the probability for the first qubit to be 1. So I'm assigning some qubit that I'm measuring, and that's basically the trick, you know, I'm projecting on 1 in the first qubit, then Qn x 0, Qn dagger x 0, that's the probability. Okay? Okay, so, and again, in the problem set you have this problem in which you need to show that this 2/3 and the 1/3 error does not matter, you can actually amplify this. So the way to do it is basically using the things that that John Wartos, so one claim that John Wartos explained, that any classical computation can be actually done quantumly. So taking the majority is a classical computation, you can do it also quantumly. So you can have, if you have such a quantum algorithm that solves something with probability 1/3, 1/3, you can actually design a quantum algorithm that has many applications of this circuit, then computes the majority, and then the output will be correct with all but 1/2 to the n probability. Okay? So, okay, so that's BQP. And no, you actually can amplify. So let me differentiate between. So let's, okay. So if you have m trials, you can get to error probability, which is 1/2 to the m. M. And I think, so Daniel was asking, is it inverse polynomial or inverse exponential? This touches upon a slightly delicate issue, which is this bounded word here, which also comes here, bounded quantum polynomial time. That boundedness needs to be more than 1/polynomial. Otherwise, we cannot distinguish efficiently. If the difference here is 1/2 plus 1/exponential and 1/2 minus 1/exponential, we can't do that in time polynomial. But if it's 1/polynomial, we can already amplify to exponentially small probability. Okay, so that's BQP. And as Stephen showed, basically, so actually as John Wartos showed, factoring is in, showed in his lecture, Shor's algorithm shows that factoring is in BQP, the problem of factoring. And what Stephen showed in his lecture is that also simulating the problem of essentially simulating TQFT is in BQP. And also simulating adiabatic computation is in BQP. And what do I mean by that? This is kind of, again, a slightly delicate issue. What do I mean exactly by simulating it? It's not that I mean that the exact infinite precision evolution of TQFT is mapped, can be tracked by this quantum algorithm. What it means is that you have to somehow talk about these TQFT and adiabatic computation models as their physical systems, but you somehow have to restrict their accuracy. You cannot really initialize their state in any more accurately than some finite accuracy. I don't know, it could be polynomial, it could be exponential, but you have some restriction on this accuracy. And with this restriction, you can, if it makes sense, you can actually treat this TQFT or adiabatic computation models as computational models. And then the problems that are solvable in those computational models, whatever they do, can be solved also in BQP. Okay? Okay. Have you actually defined this exactly, the adiabatic computational model? Stephen? I'm sorry? So just a quick reminder, just in case I'm not going to really use it, but just in case I'm going to refer to it later. Adiabatic computation is the model in which you start with a Hamiltonian with a simple ground state, easy to prepare, say, a tensor product state, and you evolve the system, you initialize the system in this ground state, and you adiabatically change H1 to H2, and if the spectral gap along the way does not close, if it's at least 1 over polynomial, then you can show using the adiabatic theorem, if the gap along the way is larger than 1 over poly n, you can show using the adiabatic theorem that the final state will actually be the ground state of the final Hamiltonian if you make this change in polynomial time. You will actually find the final the system at the end of this process at the ground state of the final Hamiltonian. And that could be a difficult Hamiltonian which could encode the solution to the problem. Okay? So that's a physical model of a quantum computer which turns out to be simulatable in BQP. Now, in fact, as I think also we have seen, also in Stephen's talk and in Adam Boulan's talk, focus talk on Monday. In fact, these problems these classes of processes can also simulate BQP. Meaning any problem in BQP can actually be encoded into those problems. So in some sense, I want to give this some words that we can use. In some sense, these are the hardest problems that are in BQP. And that we don't know how to say about factoring. So what does it mean for those problems to be the hardest problems in BQP? And how can we say that factoring is not this? What is the language that we're going to use? We don't know that factoring is not this, but we strongly suspect. So I'm going to define the notion of hardness and reduction and completeness. Okay, so reduction. Reduction is basically the idea that you can take a problem or a model and translate it into a different model. If I want to simulate or I want to understand the evolution of the physical system in one model, I can actually, or a different way, a different possibility is to, I want to understand how to solve one problem, I can actually map it into a different problem. And if I know how to solve that other problem, I will be able to translate back to get a solution for the original problem. That is the process of reducing one problem to another. So if I have two problems, L1 and L2, I want to find a mapping F, which is easy to compute. I'll talk about it in a moment, why it's important that it's easy, such that if X, so that X, F takes X to, X is an input to L1, it takes X to an input to L2. And suppose I have a solution, I have a way to solve L2. Or I can run it on a, in my lab or something. So I want X to be mapped to X prime, input to L2, such that if X is in L, then X prime is in, if X is in L1, then X prime is in L2. And if X is not in L1, then X prime is not in L2. So that will enable me to deduce the answer. Given the answer for L2, I will know the answer for L1. Okay, but the important thing is that this reduction, this is sort of an equivalence between different classes. And it's important that when we talk about equivalences, we don't somehow insert into this equivalence any really hard problem. We want this to, we want this mapping to maintain the hardness of the problem, right? So we want to preserve the hardness. So for this, we want the mapping to be very easy. So we want F to be, say, polynomial or efficiently computable. And if this is a problem that is solvable by a quantum computer in polynomial time, and this mapping is efficient classically, then we say that if this is solvable and this is solvable, and we have the reductions in both directions, then we would say that they're equivalent. Okay? So this notion gives us a way to say a problem is more difficult. It gives a partial order on the set of problems. It says a problem is more difficult than the other problem if L2, so maybe I should ask, which one is more difficult? It's very confusing. This is probably, it is very confusing. Any guess? Huh? L2. So L2 is the harder problem. Why is it the harder problem? Well, it says that if I can solve L2, I can solve L1. Okay. So, okay. What's the notion of a hard problem for a given class? A hard problem is sort of, I say that a problem sort of captures the hardness of a given class if every problem in the class can be reduced to that problem. In other words, it is harder than any other problem in the class.
But that doesn't factor into it the difficulty of the mapping F, right? I mean, you're assuming that you don't have to worry about how complicated F works.
No. I'm not assuming that. I'm saying in many cases, of course, this is impossible. I'm talking about the cases when this is possible. Veronica asked, that doesn't factor out the complexity of F. Of course, this is not possible in general. I'm just talking about the cases when this is possible. So in Stephen Jordan's talk, for example, he took this, if you remember, he took these models and he drew lines, he drew sort of connections between them. That means that you have this, you can construct this mapping efficiently from one to another. But this is not obvious. This is not always true. For example, from factoring, I cannot construct this mapping from TQFT to factoring. I don't know how to encode every problem that I have if I want to somehow run TQFT and simulate it. I don't know how to encode it into factoring. Factoring is just not strong enough the way we view it. So let me just define this notion more precisely and then. Okay, so hardness, what does it mean for a problem to be hard? So L is hard for a class C. That could be BQP, or later it could be NP, or quantum NP. A problem is hard for C if any other problem, L prime, that's it, okay, L prime in C, L prime can be mapped to L efficiently. So it can be reduced to L. Okay, and basically, okay, and then the other notion that we're using is the notion of complete. A problem P is complete. I'm sorry? A problem L, oh, maybe P is not a good notation. A problem L is complete for a class C if it is in the class and hard for the class. Okay, so every, so it is in BQP, say, TQFT is in BQP, it can be simulated in BQP, and every other problem can be simulated, can be mapped to it. We don't know that about factoring. Veronica, does this answer the question? Well, once I find the mapping, I have to make sure that it is efficient. Otherwise, I sort of encode a lot of hardness into the mapping and I lose all the meaning of this equivalence. The whole point is that this equivalence has a meaning for I mean, if I look at too large a resolution, if I allow here mappings of size of that takes exponential time, then I can, on my map, during the time I'm doing my mapping, I can solve all the problems. So it has no meaning. This mapping has to be efficient. Ah, yeah, good, good question.
If the function takes n to the fifth, then it's still, the n to the fifth is still easier to
solve.
Right. And that thing into the n squared wants to go into the.
Yeah, okay. So I think, let me repeat the question more or less. Veronica is asking, do we care about whether this mapping is n squared or n to the fifth, or if we lose some kind of factors in the powers of this polynomial, does it matter? For in our case, it doesn't really matter because of the very important, I don't know how to call it, maybe a relaxation that we're doing. We're actually, and this is extremely important, this is perhaps the most important fact that enabled theoretical computer science to actually do something meaningful. We relax this, we don't care about polynomials. We sort of relax this and say our resolution is polynomial versus exponential. Later, if you want, you can talk about more refined resolutions. But the question of whether something is polynomial or exponential is extremely important. And so essentially in quantum, especially in this school, we are interested in quantum computation, which we think cannot be simulated efficiently by classical computers. That's the whole point. That's why we think, that's why I drew this bulb larger than P. We strongly believe that BQP, though it contains P, it does not equal to P or to BPP. And the meaning is that P cannot simulate BQP in polynomial time. Okay? So this notion of polynomial is extremely important, and it is actually captured. So let me just mention in this context the extended Church-Turing thesis, the quantum extended Church-Turing thesis that was mentioned in several lectures before. okay. Basically, it says, well, maybe I shouldn't write it. Quantum extended Church Turing says that any physical model can be simulated efficiently by a quantum computer, efficiently in polynomial time. So there is this mapping of polynomial translation. Okay? So maybe for the sake of some people in the audience, I did want to mention, I think many of you know the problem of Jones polynomial, evaluating the Jones polynomial, which is related to TQFT. For those of you who don't worry about it, I won't use it later, but for those of you who do, the fact that TQFT is BQP complete means that I can take any problem in BQP and translate it to the problem of evaluating the Jones polynomial at the fifth root of unity. This translation is efficient. So I can take Shor's algorithm, the input to Shor's algorithm. I can take a number, n, that I want to factorize, and I can take the description of Shor's algorithm and classically manipulate it so that it looks like a knot, feed it to a machine that knows how to estimate the values of the Jones polynomial at a particular root of unity, the fifth root of unity, and from that answer, I will know the answer to Shor's algorithm. Okay. So, yeah, so questions up to here. Because I want to move forward to NP and quantum NP. Okay, so this basically, by the extended Church-Turing, by the quantum extended Church-Turing thesis, let me actually write it, realizable or physically realizable. Computational model. By computational model, I mean something that does do this discretization, so it actually can be somehow interpreted as input to output with some finite precision. Computational model can be simulated efficiently by a quantum computer. So the mapping, the overhead is only polynomial. So that means that actually BQP captures, if this is true, and we strongly believe it's true even for quantum gravity, if ever this this question will be solved and we will manage to actually define the theory, then it will somehow induce or it will somehow imply a computational model. And we strongly believe that the world should somehow be nice that this too will fall into BQP. And if that is true, I mean, if everything in the world, if all the information processing that nature can do is captured by BQP, why do we ever bother to go to higher classes, to larger classes? What can we learn from them? We can just cut the complexity hierarchy here and forget about the rest of it. So the answer is, well, actually it's not, one should really ask this question. Okay, and I want to give several answers. One is that we will learn a lot from understanding NP and quantum NP. And the other is that, once we know what we can or cannot do, this will actually give us tools to understand what's going on. So if we have no go theorems, it's actually helpful for yes go theorems. It actually helps us to understand what is possible. And also the sources for the hardness tell us various things about what is going on in the complexity of various, for example, ground states. So understanding the sources of hardness will also teach us things. Okay, so I'll say more about it at the end of the lecture. Okay, so, but I should say that the definition of NP is perhaps the most important contribution of theoretical computer science to the understanding of the division of different problems, whether they're easy or hard. So NP, We're now going to go higher in this picture and talk about classes NP and QNP. Now, I'm not drawing it much, much larger just because I'm short. In fact, it's not. This is not to scale. QNP should be much, much larger, and also NP. Notice that NP does not contain BQP, and we strongly believe that it doesn't hold. OK, so yeah. QNP, I'm actually just referring to QMA as QNP. Okay, so what's NP? NP is basically the class of problems which can be solved in polynomial time if you're given the answer, which is kind of a weird definition, but the problem is if you're given the answer and you need to check that this answer is correct. So for example, the definition of the Ising spin model that I had before, finding a configuration whose energy is very small could be very, very large, very, very hard. But if you're given such a configuration, it's very easy to compute the energy. Okay? So so NP is this class of problems, and more formally, NP is L is in NP if there exists a polynomial classical algorithm such that for all x, if x is an L, then there exists a more input, which is sort of the solution given to me, such that A on this x and the input y, which is called the witness, sort of the solution, answers 1. And if x is not an L, then for all y, A of x, y is 0. That might be somewhat a formal definition if you have never seen it before. But the meaning is really, let's see how it works with the Ising model. X is the description of the Hamiltonian. So remember, H is minus sum of I, j, j, I, j, s, I, s, j, then x is this description of the, and there's also another part of the input, which is a. And so x is a description of the input and a. The j, j, and a constitute x. And y, what would y be? Yeah, right. The y would be the spin configuration. And if I have it, then I can easily run through all the edges and check that, and sum over the energies and just check that the total energy is less than A. So this is a problem in NP. It doesn't mean that there is an algorithm for that. It just is a characterization of one type of a problem for which the solutions can be checked. You should notice that this is not always true. For example, if I get an answer for TQFT, if I know that the output is, I measure something and I know that the output is 0.3, I can't check it. There's no efficient algorithm that allows me to check it. So here, it's a structured thing that allows me to check whether the solution is correct. Okay, so this is there's a very famous book called the Gary and Johnson. Which contains, I don't know, hundreds of NP-complete problems. And they're all equivalent under those mappings. And the most important problem, which is probably the major problem in computer science, which you might have heard of, is 3SAT. What's 3SAT, or KSAT? So you'll have to bear with me, I think, 5 more minutes, and then we get to the quantum. So what's KSAT? So far it looks very classical, but this is going to be an example of a Hamiltonian, of a local Hamiltonian. What is KSAT? KSAT is, here's an example, Z1 and, sorry, or Z2 or V3 and Z4 or Z5 or not Z5 or Z6, etc. So it's the input to KSAT is a formula on n Boolean variables, just 0 or 1. And what we require, we have here constraints. Say there are n variables, there are m constraints, polynomially many. This is k. Here k equals 3. And what we require is that all constraints are satisfied. So for example, what is the evaluation of z1 to z3 which does not satisfy this constraint? There's only one. You see what that is? 001. Good. So you're awake. Okay, so 001 does not satisfy this constraint, but everything else does. If I put here 1, then this constraint is satisfied. Or 1 here, or 0 here. So basically I'm asking whether there is an assignment which satisfies all constraints. Okay, now, right, of course, yeah. So it turns out that KSAT is NP-complete. And the proof of that is called the Cook-Levin theorem. And it's a very, that's the theorem that is going to be extended. Kitaev took this theorem and extended it to the quantum NP version. So how would quantum NP look? We'll go to the quantum. And then we'll see how the proof goes, and then we'll generalize it to the quantum. So how does the quantum problem look? So first of all, what's quantum NP? Classical NP had, you had this circuit here, which received input X and some witness Y, which we didn't know what it was. Somebody has to give it to us. And then given the right Y, we can compute we can say that X is in the language, but if X is not in the language, there is no such Y. Quantumly, we do exactly everything the same, except everything becomes quantum. So except for the X. X is still classical, the input is classical, but both the circuit and the input, the solution, are going to be quantum. So QMA, or quantum NP. There's a reason why it's called QMA, but I won't explain it now. So quantum NP, L is in quantum NP, if, or QMA, if there exists a sequence of quantum circuits n from 1 to infinity, such that of polynomial size, such that if X is an L, then the probability that Qn times X, sorry, then there exists a state Y, which is now a quantum state, could be highly entangled, such that the probability of Qn on X and Y, probability that this is 1, is larger than 2/3. And X is not an L means that no matter what state we're checking, that probability of X and Y being 1 cannot be large, or the probability that it's 0 is larger than 2/3. Okay, notice that this y is 1. Okay, so at this point, again, this looks very formal, but now we're going to define the mother problem of quantum NP. That is going to be the local Hamiltonian problem. Let's actually write it. Local Hamiltonian problem. It might not look like it's similar to 3 to KSAT, but it is, and you are welcome to try to find the mapping while I'm writing it. What's K local Hamiltonian? The input is a description of a local Hamiltonian. H as a sum of H, J. J, say, from 1 to M on N qubits. And HJ is K local, meaning it acts only, non-trivially, only on K qubits. Okay, so tensor product with something else on the rest, with identity on the rest. And plus, there's another input, two numbers, B and A, such that B minus A is larger than 1 over poly N. Those are basically my accuracy. The question is, this is basically my accuracy. And then we want to know whether the ground value of H is less than A or larger than B. So we want to estimate the ground energy of H to within 1 over polynomial. That's the local Hamiltonian problem. Yeah?
And like, the 9 AM could be factorially large, right?
Well, if I'm assuming K is a constant. So M would be N to the K. N choose K, basically. Right? I mean, if I just pick all the all possibilities to pick K. Okay. So that's the K local Hamiltonian problem. And basically, it's asking what's the ground value of a local Hamiltonian. It's a very, very general problem. And it's a computational way of essentially asking a very, very major problem in physics. And now I think I'm going to say something that will make you very happy, or some of you, maybe not all of you, which is that there is a well-defined way to say that physics is harder than computer science. And why is that? Why does it hold? Well, because this problem, which looks like unrelated to this problem, is in fact all but a generalization of this problem. This is a special case of this. Why is this a special case? I'll show in a moment. But this is a special case of this. This can be described as a three-local Hamiltonian, in fact. And so the problem of K-local Hamiltonian, which is going to be quantum NP hard, is believed to be strongly believed to be strictly larger than NP-hard problems. Strictly harder. Okay?
Can I ask the question about the definition of this program? So does K-local Hamiltonian involve a neighboring capacity?
It doesn't have to have a geometry.
Okay.
But in fact... Okay, so let me give just a preview. We actually know not only, so once we actually prove this, that K local Hamiltonian is QMA hard, QMA complete, in fact, once we know that, this actually enables us to reduce many other problems to this problem. Oh, again, K local is that, sorry, the question was, what is the definition of K local? K local is just that HJ acts non-trivially only on K qubits. And it's just tensor with identity on the rest. That's K-local. And locality is not geometrical. That's all the restriction. Okay?
The question is, the first of the ground state in the
I'm sorry?
The question being that the ground state is actually not included in the lint algorithm.
We are assuming, we are promised that this is the case, that either this happens or this happens, and we need to decide. Okay? And essentially, this, we don't really, this doesn't worry us. I mean, it's not that we have to check that this doesn't happen. Essentially, this amounts to the to saying we want to estimate the energy to within 1 over polynomial, the ground energy. Okay? If we know how to do that, then we know how to decide this. Yeah. No restriction, absolutely. This Y could come out of thin air. Right, there's no, so Giffre says, we don't have to prepare this Y but with a quantum computer. This Y could be anything. It could be a state that somebody worked since the beginning of time till now to prepare it. Okay? So before we go to the proof, I just want to mention, suppose once we prove this, we have many, many other things that can be proved using this thing. Because basically, if we show that the K-local Hamiltonian is really quantum NP hard, then we actually show also, we can also show NP QMA hardness of many other problems by reducing them to the K-local Hamiltonian problem. That's exactly this whole idea of equivalences. It's transitive. So if I have a way to show for one problem that it is QMA complete, if I map this problem to another problem, then I also know that this problem is QMA complete. Right? If all problems in the class can be mapped to this problem, and then I map this one to this one, then this is also QMA complete. So once I have one problem, I can use it to show QMA hardness for all problems by reducing it to some other problem. So this, actually, after this was proved, many following results showed that more and more restricted K-local Hamiltonians are QMA complete. So for example, surprisingly so, one-dimensional, let me erase this. So one-dimensional translation invariant local Hamiltonians are QMA complete. I'm being here sloppy. The complexity people in the audience will forgive me. The point is that, in fact, one-dimensional systems without a translation invariant are, honest to God, QMA complete. That's already surprising because you have hardness in 1D, QMA hardness. You can encode QMA hardness in 1D. And the fact that you can actually achieve translation invariance hardness, there is some subtlety there because I won't go into the subtlety, but you can actually show that also translation invariant systems are hard. So that's surprising because we are getting to physical systems. You can show that a 2D Hubbard model and the 2D Heisenberg model are QMA hard, QMA complete. What else you can show? The problem of consistency, so the Hubbard model and the 2D and the 2D Heisenberg model are QMA, QNP, complete. So is the problem of consistency of density matrices. You're given marginals of density matrices, you're given marginals to say K tuples of particles, and you want to know if the state is consistent, that's QMA complete. That's the N representability problem. I actually put on the supplementary material a list of many QMA complete problems, QMP complete problems, written in a server by Adam Bukatz. You can see there's quite a few of them. Also some problems related to density functional theory and to checking whether some channel is an isometry or not. This is also QMA complete. So there are various other questions then. So what else can we deduce from the fact that a problem is QMA complete? Well, before I go to the proof, I want to say, think of a problem that is QMA complete. Now, suppose I have a Hamiltonian, say, a Heisenberg model, in the Heisenberg model. And I want to ask, how long will it take for the system to reach its ground state? Then I can argue that since the problem is QMA hard, I know that, at least in certain cases, it will take exponential time. Why is that? Because if it takes much less than that, because of the quantum extended Church-Turing thesis, if there was a physical process that created that, then I could actually simulate it by a quantum computer. So I could actually generate the quantum state on my own, efficiently, by a quantum computer. And that would mean that QMA is in BQP, which we strongly believe is not true. Okay? Yes. Yes. Hi. Don't try to do it in the general case.
The point is that for many people, when they say a three-part model, what they understand is a concrete transition where...
Okay. So basically, what I'm talking about here, I don't want to get into the fine details, but what I'm talking... There are various questions of how do you actually define the interactions and whether you have freedom or whether you can actually you set the interactions arbitrarily, and I don't want to get into that.
But to be clear, you don't mean that it's impossible or you don't expect people to solve a hard model with the same
arbitrary problem. With arbitrary interactions.
Right.
And
the orbit is still more. You resolve, so you have
If you don't have fine-tuning of all the parameters, then there is definitely hope. Also, maybe not in the general case because of the translation invariant proof. So there might be particular instances, even in translation invariant, even in fixed, if everything is fixed, where this is difficult in some sense. But the general... it is generally true, and I don't really understand that. This is what I said about we don't really understand why the typical physical systems are not hard, so it seems. But it is probably true that the typical interactions will not be hard. I don't know. That is something that I don't know. I don't have evidence for that. So I want to give some kind of an overview of the proof, and let me just say how we're going to go from KSAT to the K-local Hamiltonian problem. Why is this a special case of the K-local Hamiltonian problem? Well, the idea is basically very simple. This is a problem on n bits, the KSAT, and you want to know if there is a satisfying assignment. And we can actually map this to a Hamiltonian acting on n qubits, where for each such term in the formula here, I will construct a term in the Hamiltonian, which will just be this is going to be a projection on the unsatisfying assignment to those particular qubits. So this is an energy penalty to the string in case it doesn't satisfy this constraint. So each constraint corresponds to an energy penalty for the unsatisfying assignment. And you can, so this will be for the first constraint, and you can do that. This will be H1, which acts on qubits 1, 2, 3. And you can do that for all constraints. And then H will be the sum of those constraints. And you can see that the eigenstates of this H are just the computational basis, standard basis states. And their eigenvalues are just how many violations there were. And so if you have an eigenvalue with zero, then you know that there is an assignment with zero violations. And if not, then you know that this formula is not satisfiable. If the eigenvalue is larger or equal to one, you know that this formula is not satisfiable. Okay? So this is just a special case of the local Hamiltonian problem. But of course, the local Hamiltonian problem talks about general Hamiltonians. So how do you actually prove the completeness of this? The proof is actually extremely interesting. And it uses what's called the quantum circuit to Hamiltonian, the circuit to Hamiltonian construction, based on Feynman's idea, which is actually responsible to quantum computation in general. So what's the idea? Essentially, the idea is that computation is local. So let me unfold this idea. Okay, so how does one prove that ksat is NP complete? What is it that we need to prove? What we need to prove is we have a circuit. So we have a problem IL, which is in NP, and we want to map it to 3SAT. What does it mean that we want to map it to 3SAT? We want to take an instance, an input, to a problem in NP, and translate it to an input to 3SAT, to a formula, such that if this formula is satisfiable, then the input is in L, and if it's not satisfiable, the input is not in L. So what do we know about the problem? All we know is that there is a way to check. That's all we know about a problem in NP, that there is a circuit, efficient circuit, to check that the solution is correct. And that's what we're going to use in order to design a formula. So here is the circuit that checks whether the solution is correct given some witness Y, which is not known to us. How are we going to design a formula? What we're going to do is notice here that we have here something which is dynamic, and we want to move to a static problem, to a formula. So we have to encode somehow the dynamics into some static thing, essentially a classical Hamiltonian or a classical constraint satisfaction problem. So what we do is we will assign a variable to each edge here. Each edge here will have a variable. So if this is time t, we're going to have variables per edges. We'll call them zit. And the constraints that we're going to have on those variables, we're going to ask whether it is possible to satisfy the following formula. First of all, we want that at time t equals 0, the variables corresponding to the input, time here doesn't play a role. It's just an index now. We're talking about this row of variables. So these variables at this first row are going to need to be equal to the input. That's a constraint. That's one constraint. This is a constraint for the input. Now, there's also a constraint for the output that it is 1. So we need this variable to be 1. And then for each node here, which is actually a gate, we need to check that the propagation is correct by a constraint. So our constraint would just be that if this is an AND gate, say, and you assign here 1 and 1, then this cannot be 0. It must be 1. If you assign here 1 and 0, then this is OK to be everything. So you have some set of constraints. So you can, for each node, assign such a constraint. And the only way for this formula that consists of the input, the output, and all the constraints for the propagation, the only way for this to be satisfiable is if this circuit does have a y, this will correspond to the assignment of those variables, such that its propagation will end up in 1. Okay, so that's the Cook-Levin theorem. How do we move to the quantum version? Questions about this? So this is basically going from a circuit that lives in d dimensions to something at d plus 1, to a static problem in d plus 1. How do we move to the quantum version? Well, in the quantum case, what we know about a problem that's in QMA is that there is, well, we want to map it to a local Hamiltonian problem. What we know is that there is a way to check a given input. I should say something very important. Before I prove that this is complete, how do we know that actually the local Hamiltonian problem is in QMA? What would be the witness? The ground state. The ground state, if somebody gives me, I thought, I sort of treated that as obvious, but it's not that obvious. The local Hamiltonian problem is in QMA because if somebody gives me the ground state, I can estimate the energy to within some precision. In fact, somebody, I will ask him to give me a few copies of this ground state in order for this estimation to hold. But I only need polynomially many copies. So the problem is in QMA. Now I want to show that any problem in QMA actually can be translated to the local Hamiltonian problem. But now I have some problem in which it's not necessarily a local Hamiltonian problem. It's some problem. For example, consistency of density matrices, or for example, some other problem. So it could be actually a problem from some algebra. Group non-membership is it. So suppose I have a problem in QMA. I want to translate it to a local Hamiltonian. How do I do that, knowing only that I have a circuit that verifies the correct, that verifies that has some time propagation? So I have this circuit. It is polynomial size. It's unitary. It accepts y, x. It outputs 1 if x is in the language. For some particular y, if x is not in the language, it outputs 0. And let's think of that as amplified to almost probability 1 being correct. So this is your checking circuit. How do I translate it to a local Hamiltonian? Well, one first idea would be, let's just put a qubit per time step and per space. Let's do the same thing. Here's the central point. So what I want to do is I want to put assign qubits on this lattice and somehow add local constraints that will check that the propagation is correct. Here's the point. This cannot be done. Why can't it be done? Because what I actually want to check is that the propagation from time, this is time, the propagation from gamma of 0, that's the correct state in the beginning, to u1 gamma of 0, which is the correct state, u1, let's think of this as if only one gate is applied per time step. u1 gamma 0, u2 times u1 gamma 0, etc. This is the correct propagation. Well, if I'm trying to check this correct propagation, at the minimum, I have to be able to check that suppose there is no gate, that really the propagation was correct and I did nothing to the circuit, to the state. So what I have to be able to check is, given two states, alpha and beta, I have to be able to check that they are the same by local constraints. So suppose this is alpha in the state alpha, this is in the state beta, and I have to put some local Hamiltonians that will somehow check that they are the same. But there is no local Hamiltonian like that. Why? Because you can have very different entangled state that locally look the same. So there is no local Hamiltonian like that. So how do you handle this? What you do is you use Feynman's, so, right? This is a very, this is in fact a problem that comes from entanglement. And how do you handle this? Well, you handle this with the one trick that actually makes quantum computation powerful. That's the single one trick that if you know how to do that, that's quantum computation, basically. And the trick is that you can actually compute or get a handle on the inner product between as complicated two states as you want by their entanglement to a single qubit. So if you have alpha and beta, which could be states of as many qubits as you want, if they are entangled to another qubit, then that qubit, the state of that qubit, carries the information about how, whether their inner product is zero or not. If they're the same state, then that qubit will be in the state 0 plus 1. If they're not in the same state, if they're orthogonal, then that qubit will have some probability to be in the orthogonal state, 0 minus 1. In fact, it will have probability half to be in that state. So in order to check that, this could be as complicated a state as you want. It's enough to put a penalty on one qubit, which is just penalize the state 0 minus 1. Project on that state. And this is basically the idea of Kitaev's clock. I'm going to take just a few minutes to write it. Kitaev-Feynman's clock. So basically, the idea is to leverage this inner product trick to so that this control qubit will actually enable you to propagate from first time step to next time step to the next to the next. So you actually add entanglement with another register, which will be called a clock. And basically, you check that the propagation is correct only by addressing the clock. This works if alpha needs to be exactly the same as beta, but if alpha could be related to beta by a local unitary gate, then you're in the same problem if you rotate it back. So it amounts to just checking the inner product between states. So the Hamiltonian is going to be to consist of three parts. H init, which is going to check that that the state is the correct state at those qubits. H output is going to check that the state is here correct, being it's 1 at the final qubit, and that the state is correctly propagating. And so we're going to write a Hamiltonian whose ground state is the correct propagation. It's called the history state. And that state is sum over gamma of t, tensor t. That's your clock. And so h init will be project on input qubits being correct, being the right input, tensor with t equals 0. Output that project that output is 1 tensor with t being t, the final t. And the propagation is Feynman's clock, is a sum of h prop t, where h prop t is just I tensor tt plus I tensor t minus 1 minus u tensor, this is the propagator, ut t from t minus 1 to t, you propagate by ut, and the compass conjugate ut dagger tensor t minus 1. So you can check that this state is really the ground state of this, and there is no frustration. And if you actually, if you are starting with a computation which does not end at zero, at one, it ends at zero, you will be frustrated. You cannot propagate correctly and satisfy this output and input. So, okay, so let me just summarize. So let me just summarize. One thing that I wanted to say is, so I should say that the circuit to Hamiltonian construction is basically a central tool in all those reductions. And there are many, and there are several other tools that allow you to move between between different Hamiltonians. By the way, some people say that this construction reminds them of the Willer-DeWitt equation. I don't know anything about it, but if I'd be happy to learn about it if you know. There might be some connections there. What can we learn about entanglement is the one thing I want to say at the end, which is, so we know that there are all these highly complicated problems, and what does it say about the roadmap of quantum states? So the thing is this. I can talk about a hierarchy of complexity of quantum states. Quantum states which are tensor products. These are easy. Quantum states which are entangled, but which are easy from a computational point of view, you can compute anything about them. Say EPR pairs. Many products of EPR pairs. Any correlation function you can compute. Also, if the circuit is of small depth, meaning the time is much shorter, is constant, say, with respect to the size here, I think Giffre showed this, right? That you can compute correlators with this for this circuit by basically flipping it and contracting in polynomial time. So all these things are sort of classical. But Hilbert space is huge. It contains much more states than that. And in fact, these will be the classical states, the classical simulatable states. And you can have states which are generated by a BQP circuit that cannot be generated by that cannot be simulated by classical circuits. For example, states that are generated in Shor's algorithm. And above that, this still doesn't contain all quantum states. Above that, there are states that are ground states of local Hamiltonians. This can be written, the state here can be written as an approximation of a ground state of a local Hamiltonian by the circuit to Hamiltonian construction. But not the other way around. You can have a local Hamiltonian, and the point is that most likely, local Hamiltonians do not have their ground state, in the general case, does not have a description by a polynomial circuit. They cannot be generated. And I didn't talk about that, and I'm not going to talk about it, but the statement is that QMA is basically, does require the entanglement, the super entanglement that the input state can have, cannot always be simulated by a classical description of a quantum circuit. If it could, then that would mean that we would be able to somehow take this classical description and simulate it classically, and that would amount to something of the sort like QMA is NP, and we strongly believe that this is also not true. So that says that there are states, ground states of local Hamiltonians, which cannot be generated like this, and so their description is, the entanglement there is highly complex. Now, of course, the Hilbert space, just counting argument, says that Hilbert space, all the states that I was talking about, including ground states of local Hamiltonians, are just a small corner of Hilbert space. Most states simply cannot be described in any way, not as a local Hamiltonian ground state or not as a result of a quantum circuit or anything. But this gives you some distinction between ground states of local Hamiltonians and states that can be efficiently derived by a quantum circuit. So this gives some kind of a map on the complexity of ground states, and I think I'll stop.
Any questions?
Can you repeat the question, please?
I mean, the Peter Antonio, the dated frustration free.
This thing?
Yeah.
Is this frustration free? H prop is frustration free. Mm-hmm. But when you add these three terms, the whole point is that you create frustration in case X is not in the language. You cannot, if you cannot create a propagating state which will satisfy these restrictions, starting at the right point and ending at the right point, then the Hamiltonian will be frustrated. Yes. No, 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 definitely not. So the question is, can you solve NP problems with matrix product states algorithms? So, okay, one thing that I hoped to convey in this lecture is that this distinction between P not equal to BQP and BQP not equal to QMA, or quantum hard problems are not NP, that should be considered sort of a physical law. In the sense that you should not expect this to happen. Now, why? So this is sort of, if you see something like that, you should know this is, cannot be true. Now let's understand why. So why? The thing is that the you won't have a nice MPS descriptions will work only for gapped systems or for gapless systems in typical cases, like we talked about yesterday in Giffre's talk. But there are systems. The systems, the 1D QMA hard systems, for which you would not have an MPS description for their ground states, even though they're 1D.
Great, let's thank Dorit again.
The bond dimension will just grow too much.
Sorry, now let's thank Dorit again.
Thank you.